Well, my name's Tim. I work with Shepherd Staff. A little bit of just about my history, just a smidge of it. I have 30 years of law enforcement experience. And the Lord, after I completed that, the Lord kind of like arranged things for me to go to work with Jeff Jackson and with missions. And actually, up until the year 2000, I really didn't have a heart for missions at all. And God led me on a trip to Nepal that I really didn't want to go on. And by the time the trip was over, I thought, well, okay, that was fun. I'll never do that again. So after the 14th time that I went to Nepal, I kind of sunk in that God has a place for somebody with my skill set in the missions environment. So when Jeff called, my son is a missionary in Hungary. He's married to a Hungarian. Our granddaughter is the only seven-month-old I know that has two passports. She's American and Hungarian. And my lovely wife here, Susan, she rarely comes to anything that I teach, so I'm very nervous. Not because of you guys, but because of her. She's like, when I get home, she's going, well, you didn't. No. I was the chief of police in Lompoc, California. If you're familiar with California, that's where Vandenberg Air Force Base is. We shoot a lot of missiles, and there's a federal penitentiary there. So it's kind of an interesting place to come from. So let's talk a little bit about missions, and let's start with a biblical perspective. And so since we are in the book of Esther, throughout, that's the theme of this conference, I thought I'd just throw up the slide. Can you go to the next slide? About Esther and Mordecai. And I'm not going to do an expositional teaching. We don't have time for all of that. Jeff did a great job. And if you were here last night, Matt Ellison did an awesome job with that scripture. But there's some things to point out here is that when you look at Esther, particularly in chapter 2, verse 8, that they were culturally and politically sensitive. You got to remember that they're in captivity. So the Medes and the Persians, they rule the roost. They're the political entity that's in charge. And just like we heard from our brother from Syria, oftentimes when you're engaged in missions, short-term and long-term, you're the minority. And especially if, like going from west to east to other parts of the world carrying the gospel. So you are really subject to those governments that God has established there. You know, we tend to forget as American Christians that these governments, as good, bad, or otherwise as we think they are around the world, God has allowed them for his purposes, for whatever his end game reason is, for them to exist at this period of time. So when we look at the regime in Syria, God knows what's going on. He didn't forget about Syria. He didn't forget about what's going on in Afghanistan or Burma or with different people groups. He sees what's going on. And the church speaks peace, and we are his representative into those situations. So here's Esther and Mordecai. They're in a situation, but yet they're politically obedient and sensitive. When you look at Jesus and his gospel, in the Gospels, he doesn't break the law. He doesn't speak against the Roman government. He doesn't. Who does he speak against? The established church that had missed the mark. And so when we travel, we'll get to that. We need to be politically and culturally sensitive. So we grab that from the story of Esther, that they were positioned uniquely. The second point is that they esteemed and valued and protected their host culture. Jeff told this morning, kind of recapped the story about where Mordecai heard of a plot against the king's life. And so he passed that information on to Esther, who let the king know, and the assassination plot was thwarted. The other thing is, like Jeff said this morning, is along with the first point, is that Esther did not have a choice. That when they went out to select the virgins in the kingdom, she was basically drafted. So she was obedient, even though that was not her government, not her culture, she was still obedient to that. They honor God in their conflicts. So what got them in trouble, so to speak, was the same thing that got Daniel in trouble during exile, which was they were faced between a choice between honoring God and honoring man. And the choice is always honor God, because the short-term consequences to honoring man are just that, they're short-term. The consequences of failing to honor God are eternal. So Mordecai was ordered to bow down to a man, and he said, I'm not going to do it. The Bible, the Pentateuch, Leviticus tells me I'm only to bow to my God. And that's what got them in conflict with the local government. So as we go out in short-term missions, that's one thing to consider. You may be faced with a crisis point. God, you may find yourself in a position where, okay, do I choose to honor God or do I choose to honor man? And usually, in a practical sense, that is not you don't get to that point. It does happen. But usually, there's a way to honor God and not be in conflict with the local government. But we'll talk about that later. They assessed the dangerous situation, understood the risk, and they prepared by seeking God's direction. So as you look at this passage, as soon as she assessed the situation about her people and, you know, for now such a time, you may be appointed for such a time as this, she told them, the believers or the Jews, to go pray and fast for 3 days. And the plan was just like Jeff covered this morning. And then lastly, their selfless service increased their honor and credibility in their host culture. That's something people forget about both short-term and long-term missions. If you let the host culture, 9 times out of 10, if you let the host culture know, we want to make your community better. We're not here to subvert. We're not here to undermine. We're not here to destroy. We want to love on your people and make them live more peaceably with each other, then oftentimes, speaking from a governmental standpoint, being a chief and being in government for 30 years, they'll see that as a plus. I mean, my son is serving in a small town in Hungary, and he and I share a story that another long-term missionary that we had met there a number of years ago had lived in the community for 6 years and never had met the police chief, never had met anybody on city council, never had met the mayor. Just thought, why not? Why don't you walk in and introduce yourselves to these people and say, this is why we're here and this is what we're doing. Now, there's some cultures you can't do that in or some governments you can't do that with, but in Hungary you can. And so we did that on that very trip. And the police chief's response was very interesting. He says, I know. I've been watching you for 6 years. I have my own ideas about what you're up to and about what you're doing, and some of them were incorrect. So that point of how you serve in your host culture reflects upon God. Something that Jeff says all the time is, we have the honor to represent God to these people. Just when you think about that, you are God's representative. Now, I'm sure you're all very good-looking and bright, but I don't know if I would want you representing me. My wife sometimes says, you don't speak for me. It's like, yes, dear. But God has placed his gospel in our hands, and we are his representatives. So we have a tremendous responsibility. Next slide, please. So let's talk about the theology of risk. It's not just safety. You know, that's the question that people ask. So short-term mission trips, I know Bob and Pat go to Nepal. You know, and back in before 2007, Nepal was in a civil war for 15 years. Over 60,000 people died in that civil war. And when we would go to Nepal, people would ask, oh, it's dangerous there. Bad things are going to happen. Well, that's always a question that we ask. So is it about our personal safety? Is it about the safety of the people on the ground there? Is it safety of the long-term missionaries? We'll answer that in a minute. Does preparation and safety conflict with faith? A lot of the comments we hear from when we teach in churches is, well, We're serving the Lord. Of course we're going to be saved. Well, if I could just be, sometimes our stupidity oversteps our diligence to be good followers of Christ. So sometimes our failure to plan puts us in a position to where we are not in a position to be used by God. And planning, proper planning, will put you in a better position to be used and to represent the gospel. And then, so that question is always asked. If God is in control, why should I be concerned about safety? And next slide, please. Okay, so here's the theology of risk, and usually I'd go through each one of these. But if you had to look at these statements, which of these do you think is the most crucial that we should be concerned about? I hear the gospel. Anything else? The most concerned. Which one is preeminent? It's like in Sunday school, when, you know, if you don't know the answer, Jesus, right? That's the answer. You're right. It's the gospel. And I actually have kind of put them in my own opinion of hierarchical order. You know, yes, your actions as a short-term missionary can affect your own personal safety and your own personal welfare. But if you're a short-term missionary, or even if you're a long-term missionary, and if you've counted the cost of where you're going and what you're doing, that should be it should be pretty low on your priority list. Being a short-term or long-term missionary is not Christian tourism. It's not. And the church has treated it like that. I've been guilty of that. When I first started working with short-term missions as a, you know, just part of a team, I had no clue that I just thought I was going to a country to, like, help with a children's home and love on little kids. And really, I didn't think of the concept of being God's representative. So as I matured in the faith, I started realizing that, you know, the welfare of the people on the ground, even the welfare of the people, unsaved people, the unreached people, because really, when you think about it, if somebody came in here, and this is kind of a crude example, and we had a missionary, and we had a pastor, and we had a bunch of believers, and then we had three unsaved guys, and I'm the cop, and I got to throw my body in front of, I should throw it in front of the three unsaved people, because everybody else is bought and paid for, right? So my job, I used to tell our pastor at our church, because with Bob here, he's with security, like, look, if somebody comes in, you're like the last guy I'm jumping on. He's like, well, thanks a lot. He said, well, I'm telling you. So, you know, it's the people who are unsaved that have not made a decision for Christ that really our conduct and the attention we bring of forces that would do us harm, those are the ones that are in the most peril. But when you look at it, the bottom line is the reputation of God's work or the gospel. We're his representative. And if we act stupidly with that, we can affect generations. I don't know what kind of household you grew up in, but you hear the biases of your parents. You hear our kids heard our biases. And sometimes in the comfort and the relaxed atmosphere of your own home, you'll say stuff that you don't quite mean. But that gets passed on generation to generation. So your biases, your prejudices, some of the things that you wouldn't say in public. But yet now you've infected your kids with some of those things. And so imagine you're a Syrian Muslim and some Christian comes into your community and does some really audacious, stupid things that are cross-culturally offensive, and they are condescending and demeaning, and they go home and they discuss amongst their family. That infects generations of people that would otherwise may have been more receptive to the gospel. So protecting the integrity of the gospel is what safety is about, bottom line. Now, me as a security professional, do I care about your safety? Absolutely. but I want to protect in a way that glorifies God. So when you are safe on the mission field and you act in a way of deference to the local culture, which is the best way, safest way, then you're representing the gospel well. Let's look at the next slide. So, again, we're short on time, but some of the principles of theology of risk is that one things you can do with risk. So there's really only three things you can do with risk. You can accommodate risk. You can recognize what it is, the risk is, and you can make adjustments and accommodate for it. You can ignore it and say, well, that threat doesn't exist. Doesn't make the threat any less real, but you can ignore it, and there are a lot of people that do. It's like, I choose not to acknowledge that. I'm going to go ahead with whatever I'm doing and whatever, however the chips fall, let them fall. So you can accommodate it, you could ignore it, or you could shrink in fear from it. Those are the three responses to risk. And shrinking in fear is not effective. Ignoring it is not wise. And so we want to accommodate risk. And so accommodation means it reduces our vulnerability, it promotes smart ministry, and it promotes good stewardship of our resources. So hence the title of this kind of short, brief talk is that safety is good stewardship. If you're spending so much time dealing with risk because you have not planned ahead, or dealing with logistics because you haven't planned ahead, then that's time from the ministry that's being taken away, and so your resources are being squandered. It's not about safety, it's about ministry. Ministry must be the focus of contingency, or if we fixate on safety, the ministry can become ineffective and eventually cease. And sometimes, especially with long-term missionaries, you find yourself in a place like a geopolitical change to where now, like what's going on in India. If you guys are familiar with what's going on in India, since Modi became the prime minister of India, he's really fanned the flames of fundamentalist Hinduism to the point that they're openly persecuting Christians, beating them, burning their Bibles, setting their house on fire, things like that. And certain provinces, that's actually encouraged under Modi, the prime minister. He's a very fundamentalist Hindu. So in those situations, a white American Christian in certain provinces actually brings more attention to the Christians that are serving there and hinders their ministry. Doesn't help it, because it brings focus, governmental focus and political focus on them. And why do they hate the Americans so much, or Western Christians so much? There's a couple of websites, Twitter accounts that you can go to. One's called No Conversion, hashtag No Conversion. The other one's called, I'm having a senior moment. I'll remember it. But there's these two websites, their sole purpose, and Twitter accounts. One's a Facebook account with a Twitter account, the other one's this Twitter account. No Conversion is the one to start with. Soul Vulture is the second one, sorry. Hashtag Soul Vulture. Their sole purpose, S-O-L-E, purpose of these media outlets is to out Christians in India. So identify this person's a Christian, this is where they live, there's a green light, you can do what you want to these people. And they highlight some of these evangelists that are fleecing the flock, so to speak, for money. And they put those on these media outlets to say, this is the way all Christians are. So the people who are not representing the kingdom well, they are their poster childs. So that reputation precedes us as we go into those regions. So when you show up as a white American, I'm a Christian, that's the first thing they think. Because the gospel's reputation has been besmirched. So it's about ministry, being safe, being culturally aware. The risk versus ministry, is the ministry at a crucial stage? Are believers at greater risk if I stay or if I go to that location? And then there is wisdom beyond ourselves. We all seem to think we study up on a subject, and I'm glad you guys are all here. But we get to a point where we think we know. And the best story I have for that, I think I have time for a short one, is my very first trip to Nepal. Went to this children's home with about, at the time, it was like 50 or 60 kids. And the kids were kicking the soccer ball around. And it was like flat. And it's like, you know, it's a flat ball. So I get out there, I'm going to play with the kids, right? And the soccer ball has a hole in it the size of a quarter. And it's like, and it, pum, 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 and it's not really going anywhere. And like, man, this really sucks for these kids, you know? I'm going to be the big guy. I'm going to walk down like a mile to the little center of the village. And I saw some soccer balls hanging there. So I walked my American self down to this little thing. And I plopped down my $2 to get the soccer ball. It's Nepal, of course. And I proudly bring it back and hand it to the woman who's running the children's home. I said, oh, the kids are going to love this ball. She said, oh, thank you, Captain Tim. I was a captain at the time. Thank you so much. We appreciate you. We love you. And then she took the ball and went up the stairs. I'm like, wait, give it to the kids. Oh, she said, oh, come with me, Captain Tim. We go up to the storage shed on the roof. She opens the door. There's like 12 brand new soccer balls. I'm like, Domo, what's going on? She goes, oh, well, we put the hole in the soccer ball on purpose because there's corn on the other side of the fence. And the kids hit the ball over the fence, and it breaks the corn. And if the corn's no good, then we don't eat. So me, I'm trying to fix the problem from the American perspective. And she's looking at it from a Nepali perspective of, like, our corn's more important than these kids kicking a soccer ball around and breaking our corn. So sometimes we think we know. But there is wisdom beyond ourselves that's valid. That's their cultural wisdom. Rely upon that. Find a trusted local national and rely upon that. Okay, next slide. Okay. Oh, okay. It's supposed to come flying in, but we have a glitch. So I'll just ask the question. Of these threats, what is the number one killer of Western expatriates? Traffic collisions and stepping off the curb looking the wrong way. I don't know how many times, like, you've been in a left-hand drive country and you're going, oh, there's no car coming. You know, and next thing you know, it's like you're almost flattened. So, yeah, car collisions. What's number two? You got it. Well, actually, it's a kind of a tie between illness and crime. So, terrorism is at the bottom. You are more likely to get struck by lightning than you are to be kidnapped by a terrorist. Now, you can increase those likelihoods if you go to places like Ouagadougou it's terrible getting old. Okay, you go to Nigeria. You stand on a corner and proclaim that you're a Western missionary, your likelihood of being kidnapped just went up exponentially. So there are a lot of kidnappings in Nigeria, lots of kidnappings. I have a friend who's a former police officer, hostage negotiator, and he almost all the time is in a hostage negotiation with people for missionaries in Nigeria, constantly. I think right now, last time I checked, there's like 8 American Western Christian expatriates in custody or kidnapped right now that have not been released in Nigeria. So you can increase your chances of these things, but statistically speaking, that's kind of the order. So if you could eliminate half of those threats easily before you even left, wouldn't you? Absolutely. So, next slide, please. So, I've kind of put through this together because I knew we'd be short on time, because this actually is like half a day or longer presentation or synopsis of education. But I would start with, in your preparation meetings for your short term, is number one, have a mission statement or mission focus. So what I'll do with, especially with some of our long-term missionaries with shepherd staff that are going to go abroad for the first time, I say, look, I'm going to give you an assignment. Here's your assignment. Point number one, why are you going? Why are you going to this people group? What do you envision? What does success look like to you? Write me one paragraph of that. Why you're going? Why this people group? And why? What does success look like? You can also add the question: are you engaged with that people group here and now in the United States? Because all these people groups that we're going to see, most of them have refugees here. And if you want to work with Tibetans, like there's 30,000 Tibetans in Toronto. There's like 8,000 in Queens. There's probably a bunch of them here. If you see a Himalayan restaurant, they're probably Tibetan working in it. So ask them to write a missional statement, everybody on your team. And then whoever's leading it, read those missional statements, because if people are conflicting of what their expectations of the trip are, that can lead to conflict. If some people think we're going to stop in Bangkok and they got the best shopping in the world, and I was on a missions trip where a senior leader in the church, the whole focus, the whole trip, all he talked about was, can't wait till we get to Bangkok. Man, they got some great shopping in Bangkok, man, I'm going to get some stuff. And then we had plane delays and everything, and ruined his shopping experience. What a shame. So get everybody on the same page is the bottom line. But don't do it from up here. If you're the leader, let them tell you what their expectations are and then guide it from there. If you just tell them, well, this is what we're going to do, they'll just nod their head. And then they'll think in their mind, well, I wish we could do some shopping. Or I wish we could have some time to do some trekking. Or, man, the Himalayas look beautiful. I'm using Nepal. That's a frame of reference for me. I've always been to Iraq and other places that a lot of your missionaries have gone. But that's my main frame of reference. But people, they have their own ideas of stuff they like to see and do. So get them all out there before you go. It reduces conflict. Second, I give them an assignment of go online to the State Department. You can look at, number one, you should register for, and if you are taking notes, write this down. You should register with the STEP program, the STEP. STEP is the Safe Traveler Enrollment Program. And what that does is you put in the country you're going to, or even if you have a family member living there, you can do it from here. The State Department sends you every alert, every notice. There's a federal law that says in the United States that any notice given to a federal employee deployed in a country abroad has to be shared with every American citizen who requests it. So if they send a bulletin out to their embassy employees that say there's going to be a protest at the corner of X and Y, don't go there tomorrow, they have to put it out to everybody who's enrolled in the STEP program. And all they want is your email address. I think they want your name and then the country you want to go to, not even a length of duration. And I get a similar report every morning and every afternoon that encompasses all of them. So it takes me about an hour to read them. And it hits on the highlights of, like, the stuff that's going on around the world. So assign your short-term people to do research, and you ask them to do these things. Look up the country report, because every country has a State Department report. Look up private intelligence sources like Brigada, Stratfor, Consilium, Red X, I think Red 5 is another one. These are all private intelligence, and Consilium's a Christian-based private intelligence company. And they have, like, this is what's going on, this is what's the impact on Christian expatriates. Give their sense. So first assignment is their mission, what their vision is. Tell them to tell you what are the top three crimes committed against Westerners of where we're going to go. That's their assignment. Then the next thing, what are the top three illnesses or accidents that Westerners will suffer? So, like, if you're going to Liberia, Ebola is still an issue. So it's like, don't go out and pet wild monkeys and stuff, right? Which is mitigating a risk. And then the last thing is, what groups are operating in that area, or what natural disasters? So have them give you a report of what they find and make that part of your preparatory meeting, because if they do the research, they own it. Here's the other part. Is everybody here from Philly, or people from other churches? Other? Any others? Okay. If you're in leadership at another church, pastors don't like to hear this part, but I'm not a pastor, so I get to say it. Satan's not stupid. He uses the legal system. If he can expose your church or your organization to a lawsuit by somebody who's either a really weak believer or a non-believer who's going on a trip, he'll do it. By having them do their own research in their own handwriting and handing it in to you, you have verifiable proof that they've been briefed on the dangers of where you're going to go. It's better than me standing up here saying, you know, it's dangerous to go to Kurdistan. You know, it's really not. But you know, if I say, you know, it's dangerous to go to Syria, it is. It's dangerous to go to South Sudan, it really is. South Sudan's really a hot spot right now. So putting it in their own handwriting protects you liability-wise. And after every briefing, have them have a sign-up sheet, have them doc. And so I think one of the next slides is going to, and we're not there yet, talk about documenting everything you do. And not like detailed notes. You just, okay, we had this meeting. This is what we discussed. This is the stuff they turned in. And here's the roll sheet everybody signed. So later down the road, if they get kidnapped and their family member, or heaven forbid they get killed, and their family member said, well, they were never informed it was unsafe, and we're going to sue. Satan uses that to hinder your church's ministry and the mission field. And also major missions organizations that have been sued for those things. And Satan uses that to destroy the outgoing of the gospel. So protect the gospel every which way, every resource you have. So be strategic in your cultural relations. That's a whole class in itself, strategic cultural relations. Things like, if you're in a country, like my story about the police chief in Hungary, when you go, there's this, when, especially in collectivistic cultures, there's this one down theory, if you've ever heard of it. If you put your, the whole story of the Jesus turning water to wine is part of that one down theory. When Mary took her problem, and she was helping this family put on this wedding, and put it in the hands of her son, who she knew could fix the problem, she was putting her face in his hands. So he had to act to save her face. So when you understand that culturally, and I go to the police chief in Hungary, which is not a strong collectivistic culture, but it's more collectivistic than ours, and I say, look, we're submitting to your authority, or we're here in your town, and we know that you want to keep this town safe, so we want to help you in any way that we can. Now he has an obligation to protect you, to save his face. And so that's kind of like knowing that, recognizing that culturally could make you safer, depending on the culture you're going to. We don't have a lot of time for that. So these are kind of the questions that you ask and have them respond to your preparation. And then if there's any training that you want to connect with, there's some great online training. Concilium has some online training. And that's spelled Concilium. Just this week, Crisis Consulting International, their website is cricon.org, cricon.org. They just came out this week with a new 60 or 90 minute short-term preparation video web-based training. There's also Travel Safety Solutions out of Florida that's about the same, about a 90-minute training. Anything you can do that with, especially with first-time short-term mission people who want to go on trips, it raises their awareness. It prevents redundancy with those who've been on many, but it teaches them about situational awareness, teaches them about rally points, teaches them about cultural sensitivity, teaches them some of the things that we've been talking about, and it's verifiable proof, because if you can type into the program that I'm the elder at this church and I'm the missions pastor or whatever, you get sent verification that they took the training. So it actually, and they're not really that expensive. You can get, I think the one, Travel Safety Solutions, is like $30. So I think it is. And I don't know how much Bob Clamser's is. So that's with CRICON. So next slide. So you can use training. And in your meetings, like I said, now you gather what their vision for the trip is, and you bring that to the group, and you kind of do notes, and you hone that down, and you clarify what the vision of this mission is. And just tell them, be honest with them, straight up. Say, look, okay, we'd love to have time to shop in Bangkok, but if it doesn't happen, that's not why you're going. Oh, we'd love for you to trek in the Himalayas for a few hours, but if that doesn't happen, that's not why we're going. We're going to carry the gospel. So if you get stuck in the airport for 6 hours in Pokhara, Nepal, which is an airport like smaller than this room, but yet you get to share the gospel with one Tibetan man who's never heard it in his life because you're stuck there for 6 hours, that's the reason why you're stuck. And that's the reason why God has you there. Doesn't mean he doesn't want us to go shopping or trekking, but he has a purpose and we're on mission. There's a time to work and a time to play. And even our play should glorify God. So do your country regional briefings. Gather your intelligence and brief on what's going on in those countries. Set up a communication plan. This is one that people don't think about a lot. So, and we do this with long-term and short-term, but even I think short-term is more critical. There should be somebody back home paying attention. So if you go 24 hours and nobody has contact with the team, or somebody from the team is like out of communication for 3 hours, who's going to push the button to like, we got a problem? Have a plan. How are you going to communicate? What method? Is it by email? Is it by phone? Is it by WhatsApp? Is it, you know, it could be satellite phone. There are some countries in the world that if you go through customs with a satellite phone, you'll be arrested. You can't carry a satellite phone without government permission in China, period. You can have one with government authorization, but if you try to smuggle one into China, you'll be arrested. So, and usually deported. And from my perspective as a safety professional, countries like Morocco, your greatest threat in Morocco is not from terrorists. It's like you're going to be arrested and deported, and you'll never be allowed back in that country again. And the reputation of the gospel. So I'm not worried about you dying in Morocco. I am worried about you dying in South Sudan. So, but have a communication plan. It's like if you're out of communication for X amount of time. So there's plenty of mechanisms you can use. There's a thing on the market called Spot that's tied into a Garmin global positioning satellite, and it has a SOS button. If you press that, there's a company down in Houston called Geos that their sole existence is to rescue people in like 160 countries. And they got teams in France and the Middle East and all over the place. So if you hit that button, and you buy the insurance, I think it's like $25 a month to get the rescue piece. To just get the I'm in trouble, call somebody piece, it's like $10 a month. And then the device is less than $100. So if that's your way, then okay. And you can program in, it's like call Carlos at Calvary Chapel, Philly as one of the contacts. So I want to like get like 50 of them, and program them all to call Carlos and just hand them out to people around the world. Yeah. So have a communication plan and then stick to it. So if you go 3 days and you haven't heard from your person on the ground, resist the urge to go, oh, it's probably okay. Push the button. You know, what does that mean? You have to define what that means. So if you have an on-the-ground local contact, make that phone call. Hey, we haven't heard, you know, from Susan in 3 days. Have you seen her? Oh, we thought she went home. Now you really got a problem. You don't know where she's at. She's not in the home country or the host country. She could be anywhere. She could be in a jail. She could be taken as a captive, as a hostage. So if you're doing a team, make sure when you go through customs, you have a simple truthful statement. A lot of people call it different things. This is the easiest one for me to remember. But if you're going to do, let's say you're going to Morocco, and you're going to visit a missionary who runs a company that makes bricks for building buildings in Morocco, and they stop you in customs, every person on your team should say, we're here to visit a friend who makes bricks for building buildings in Morocco. Well, you run into problems when one of the team says, well, we're here to teach English to little Berber children. Oh, yeah, we're here to paint buildings. Yeah, we're here to, pass out Bibles. That'll get you arrested like now in Morocco. So make that statement consistent across your team. There have been cases where youth teams going to Morocco in particular have left the United States, gotten to Heathrow. They're going through Heathrow, and the customs officer will take the little 15 or 16-year-old side and say, where are you guys all going? Oh, we're going to go help this church in Morocco. So there's this international law that says, if you know that a group of people are going to go to another country and violate their laws intentionally, and you send that group on, that's negligence on the country that's sending. Those two youth groups that I know of were stopped in England, turned around, and sent back to the United States because they made statements that we're going to do ministry in Morocco. It's illegal there. So make sure your simple statement is true and everybody's on the same page. And make sure the people on the back home have the same statement. They pull you aside. They pull your 15-year-old high school student or 17-year-old high school student aside. What are you guys doing on your trip? Oh, let's call your parents. Parents going to, oh, yeah, they're on this missions trip. They're going to convert Muslims to Christians. That's the wrong answer, right? So have a communication plan. Once you're on the ground, and those of you who've led short-term teams know this, you should always have a local trusted national or a local, like a missionary that you're visit that can point you to the right directions. But establish rally points. As soon as you get on the ground, say, you see that bell tower? If you get separated from us, you go stand under that bell tower. Some place that you can see from a distance, a landmark. Some place that you know from your advance work that is safe. Or make it a movie theater. Or make it a store. Don't make it, like, on the street. Because there's nothing worse for situational awareness than some 18-year-old standing there looking around like they don't know where they're at. And they become... And I'm not worried about terrorism. I'm worried about criminals. Like, they're right for a robbery. They have no clue where they're at. They don't speak the language. So, yeah, have your rally points and contingency plans. And then your documentation, like I said, have all your ducks in a row, both preparing and on the field. Make sure you have everybody's passport. I make up little cards that go in people's wallets. I don't, depending where we're going, but most of the time I don't put the home missionary's phone number on it, but I will put the embassy on it, local hospital phone number on it, the police phone number on it, and they carry it in their wallet. So if they get separated, even better, if you have missionaries on the ground, have them prepare the card in the local language, and then have parentheses, you know, in English so the kid can just point to it and say, to a local person and say, can you call this number? So have your stuff ready. Next slide. Okay. Wow. I want to give you guys time. It'll suffice to say that, can you go ahead one more slide? I want to make sure that this is the end. No, it's not. One more? Okay. We're not going to get there. Okay, go back two slides. When you look at the gospel, and I can get, there's a slide here I can give to anybody, but there's tons of, when I first started down this road, I thought, what is safety and security? Where is that found in the Bible? It's all over the place. It's in Nehemiah. It's in Psalms. It's in New Testament, Old Testament. Jesus, his second temptation was to risk his ministry by throwing himself off the temple, just because he was promised that, hey, you've got credibility. The angels will protect you. So prove it. Well, that's self-centered and that's stupid. And Jesus' response to Satan was, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. He used scripture. But there's two places where Jesus himself sent people out. One's in Matthew 10, conveniently, the other one's in Luke 10. And in Matthew 10, he sent out the 12 disciples, and he names them right before he does this. And he sends them out, and the instruction is similar to the 70, but not the same. He tells them, don't take any cloak, don't take extra money, don't take all these resources, because I want you to depend on the locals, the people who receive the gospel, because that makes them engaged with you. So I would encourage you, it's like, yeah, do your preparation, but depend on the locals so there's engagement. The other thing that Jesus said is, in both those cases, was, I'm sending you as sheep into the wolves. And the difference between the 70 and the disciples is he adds to the disciples in Matthew 10, so therefore be as wise as serpents, but yet as gentle as doves. So Jesus himself said for us to be shrewd when we engage other cultures. And in fact, when he admonished the disciples, he said, don't go to Samaria. Don't engage the Gentiles. Go only to the people of Israel. Why? I mean, that's a whole hour right there. But his disciples had specific marching orders. When he sent out the 70, he said, go to everybody. Go to the Gentiles. But anyway, there were specific things about people that would come against them, try to drag them into court, try to disrepute the gospel. So there's plenty of scripture that points us to the direction of safety for the sake of the reputation of the gospel, especially in a cultural context. So I'm not going to cover each of these points. What I'd rather do for the next, we're really done. So we only had like 45 minutes, but I'll answer any questions you guys got, and we can go off on a tangent, and I'll give you my card, and you can email me till the cows come home. Any questions? Yeah.
You rattled off a lot of specifics and spelling and stuff like that. Is there a way to get all that?
No. Once you see me afterwards, and I'll send you whatever I've got. It's not proprietary, but it helps if you narrow it down. When I first left law enforcement, they call it retired. I'm actually working more now. But when I first left law enforcement and I walked into this arena and met with guys from IMB, New Tribes, Pioneers, and New Tribes and now Ethnos 360, Cross World, and met their security directors, I was in a whole different world. It's not law enforcement. It's not straight security. It's a balance between being smart, representing God, the gospel well, and it's not all about safety. It's more about presenting the gospel in the right context. Because if you show up in downtown Tehran with a Nazarene like t-shirt, you know the emblem, the Arabic emblem for Nazarene that says, you know, all Muslims are going to burn in hell, and they're not going to listen to you. The gospel's going nowhere. So there's a, every culture has an on-ramp for the gospel. So yeah, I'll share that. Anything you want, but if you can narrow it down. Any other question? Really? Which one? What? Well, actually, there's like 30 more slides.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, yeah. But this is the where I was going to end. So go ahead and show the next slide. And I'll send this to whoever wants it. Just you, if you email me, I'll send you. Okay. My email is Tim, T-I-M, at S-S-M-F-I. Shepherd Staff Mission Facilitators Incorporated .org. What's that? Shepherd Staff Mission Facilitators Incorporated. So SSMFI. I have some cards. I will leave them up here. Yeah, there's the next slide. Did you get that? You want to see the next one? That one? Well, situational awareness is a whole, you got another hour? But basically, it's being aware of, it's actually a started as a aeronautics term. And it's the concept of a pilot knowing what's in front of him, beside him, below him, above him, and behind him. And a lot of people don't know the fact that this in many fighter aircraft, the reason why you have the second person is to be the eyes and ears to the back side of the plane. They do other things, but that's one of their primary purposes. So situational awareness is when you're in the a foreign environment. Show the next slide. not monkey business. We could do that for fun as a closer. Okay, so this would be, like most of us right now, you should be, the best place you should be right now is in the, I'm colorblind, so it's that yellow or greenish, the relaxed awareness. That's where we should be right now. If you're like falling asleep or when you're watching the Eagles game and they're getting pounded or they're ahead by 40 points and you're falling asleep on a Sunday afternoon, you're in white. You're oblivious to what's, or the times when you've been driving down the road and you don't remember how you got there because you're talking to somebody or listening to the radio, that's being in white. If somebody comes up and goes, while you're in white, you do that. If you're in yellow or in focused awareness, you won't jump. Because you're watching them, you're seeing the hands go like that, you won't jump. So as a messenger of the gospel, especially when you're in a foreign environment, you should operate in there and be prepared to act. The analogy is like this. You're driving, you don't know where you're going, that's white. If you see the sign that says deer ahead, and you think, there might be some deer, now you're in yellow. You look to the side, there's three or four deer. Now you're in, like, ready to act. You're in focused awareness, like, there's a sign, there's some deer. They could jump in the road. If they jump in the road, now you're in red. Okay? If you're in white and they jump in the road and you're not anywhere in the middle, you go straight to black, which is sensory overload and you shut down. And that happens in armed robberies all the time. All the time. In my career as a cop, when bad guys would run into a bank and shoot, you know, and some of the tellers give great descriptions. Others, like, a guy was Mexican, and he was like a short black guy or a white guy. And they get the clothing descriptions all wrong because they were totally in shock because they were oblivious before it happened. They weren't in a state of awareness. So why don't we do this? I'll pray. We'll close it out. My partner here can show the monkey business video as our closer after I pray. And then you guys, and we'll go eat. And I'll stay around if anybody has questions. Father, when we're in the mission field or actually anywhere, our job is to represent you well. that represent the gospel well as being part of the kingdom. And Lord, you give, there are many parts to the kingdom and many talents and many tools, and some of us are the gatekeepers and some of us are in the watchtower and some of us are sounding the alarm, and others are binding up souls. So in whatever role these people have in short-term and or long-term missions, that you would have them represent you well. That you would give them the tools and the heart and the energy to do that. So we ask a blessing upon their day and as they go forward, and for the rest of the speakers today. In Jesus' name, amen.